Anything else? Surely I'm forgetting something, but in the meantime, you'll turn to Judges chapter 7, please. I have no videos for you this week, although as I prepared the message, I thought of several videos that I could have shown you. Videos from Lord of the Rings to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. A lot of clips from films that I could have presented this morning. But I would choose to begin rather with a short quotation from the prophetic voice of David Wells' book called No Place for Truth. The book is about 13 years old, published in 1993, which means its ideas are probably 5 years older than that. Nevertheless, I think the point is salient enough to mention it to you this morning. He writes, "It is perhaps one of the oddities of God's providence that reformation in the church's life, of which the evangelical world surely stands in need, has often been abetted, if not triggered, by social disorder. Before God rebuilds, he often pulls down, plucks up. Unhealthy habits of mind and injurious patterns of life that might have been in the making for a long period of time are often more easily swept aside by social chaos than by a preacher's appeals to conscience. It was so with unhappy regularity throughout the Old Testament, and it seems to have been so throughout the life of the church." The back of your bulletins is an outline. One wonders where the prophetic voices who are announcing that God is shaking the world as he prepares the church. One wonders where they are. One might further wonder what the task is that he is preparing for the church or preparing the church for. Let's begin by getting the idea out of our heads, the notion out of our heads. Let's begin by getting this idea gone from our vicinity that God needs us, that he needs us in great numbers, or that we in any way increase his odds of winning. It is time, I think, for someone to make the announcement that the world is not ours. It is a basic tenet of biblical theology that this world belongs not to us, but rather to God. We are here for a while. We are tenants, if you will, pilgrims, squatters. The world, all that is in it, the universe in its entirety, belongs to God, the Creator. We are here for a while. Some say that we should make the best of it while we can, get the most out of life that we can. But this world, even if we happen to live in it and tend to it, is not our world. The psalmist said it loudly in Psalm 24, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and all who live in it." But to a large extent, man has taken over this planet. And to be sure, we are attempting to take over other planets too. There's a picture of Mars just there. We are trying to take over Mars. But the way man goes about things, even Mars would be ruined practically as soon as we arrived. I still wonder what vestiges of this culture must be torn down before the Lord can begin to rebuild his righteous people here. I think I have a clue, but I'm not yet brave enough to try and apprehend it or to try and comprehend it. It's terrifying to think of. What idols and altars must soon be destroyed before God begins to rebuild? Israel lived in a land, the Promised Land. What a glorious place the Promised Land must have been. Nevertheless, a very few short years after they arrived, the land was already overrun with idols and altars to the fertility gods of Canaan, the Baals, the Asherah poles. The people of God were prostituting themselves to the devils of the land, making a mockery of God, the Lord of hosts, and shaming themselves in the process. But God is no small God, and things that go on in God's world are not likely to be unnoticed by God. And so for 7 years, the writer of the book of Judges says, God gave them into the hands of the Midianites. And in an effort to get their attention, he allowed the Midianites to raid the land. Hear these verses from chapter 6. "Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land. They ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock in the tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. The gods they had hoped would protect them, the gods of Asherah and the gods of Baal, the fertility gods, did nothing for Israel, didn't protect their crops that they had hoped would. They were stealing. Nothing was spared, neither sheep, cattle, nor donkeys. We also get the idea that these raids were rather continuous, rather ongoing. It says whenever Israel planted a crop. Didn't matter what sort of crop it was. Whenever they planted, the Midianites, the Amalekites, they swooped down on the land and they took it for themselves. The Midianites were upon them. We get the idea also that this force, this invading force, of marauding, stealing pagans was large. It says they were like a swarm of locusts. When you get to chapter 7 and Gideon goes into battle, it says there they were thick as locusts. Their camels were so numerous, they were like sand on the seashore. This was no small army that invaded Israel in the promised land. It was impossible to count them. Israel was defeated. They at least had yet a remnant of sense to call out to the Lord. And the Lord heard them, but the Lord's response seems a little difficult to swallow, perhaps. Look at these verses, 8 through 10. This is what the Lord God of Israel says. He sent them a prophet. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them from before you, gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship other gods of the Amorites in the land in whose land you live. But you have not listened to me. But while the prophet was saying these things, the Lord was also seeking out someone. And he comes across a man named Gideon. Gideon doesn't appear to be a very strong man. Gideon's a farmer. Simple farmer. This man named Gideon, he's no Samson, a man of mighty strength. He's no Deborah, a woman of mighty poetic skills and intelligence in battle. This is Gideon, the farmer. Someone, one of the books that I read in preparation said his name means chopper or hacker. This is no smooth man here. This is a man that's all cut up. He's nothing especially special. By his own admission, he says, his clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and he is the least in his own family. Nor does he sound especially grateful for the assignment. If the Lord is with us, he says, then why has all this happened to us? Where are the wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us, and he's put us into the hands of Midian. No. Gideon was not one who seemed favorably inclined to be the catalyst who would change the situation they were in. And he didn't sound too happy with the Lord's sense of humor. Choose me, he says. Choose me? Why? Why would you choose me, the weakest of the weak, so that we can be further humiliated? God did miracles for our fathers, and now he wants me, the weakest of the weak, to go and fight this army of locusts called Midian? Nice, Lord, nice. Real, real nice. But you hear this echo of God saying, I will be with you. It sounds nice. It sounds like a lot. But sometimes I think our eyes deceive us. Sometimes our hearts play tricks on us. I will be with you. But me thinks God knew what he was doing. Huh? We don't think for a minute that God was unaware of who Gideon was, do we? No? Surely God knew who Gideon was, right? Gideon, Midian. He knew Gideon was a man whose identity was that of weakness, whose heart was riddled with fear, whose mind was racked with doubt, and who was as reluctant to accept his assignment as Moses was to accept his. And that he was a man who would later become vengeful. A man who would later become a snare to Israel. Oh yes, I think God knew exactly who he was choosing when he chose Gideon. Dangerous, dangerous type of God that he is. Well, that's fine. But I don't even know who you are, the story goes on. Wait here, I'm going to go make dinner. I'm going to go make an offering. You wait here. Will you wait here? I'll wait. Okay, you wait here. I'll come back. We'll talk. And then the Lord, and by this point in the story, near the end of chapter 6, we are well aware of the fact that this angel that Gideon saw was much more than an angel, much more than a messenger sent to help God's people. Ah, sovereign Lord, Gideon says, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. Well, we wouldn't be frightened of an angel, but if an angel was something more than an angel, then we might think, ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen your angel face to face. They used to call these theophanies, appearances of Christ before the appearance of Christ. Then the Lord took this weak man, the weakest of the weak, and assigned him a task. Isaiah saw God and received a task. Abraham saw God, received a task. Joshua saw God, received a task. Moses, Paul. So I say, go ahead. Go ahead. Ask for a visit from the Lord. Ask for God to come down and tell you face to face what his will is for your life. But don't expect that you will see him and remain unchanged, unchallenged, or uncommissioned. Because if you ask to see the Lord, I guarantee you the Lord is going to give you a job to do. He gave Gideon a job to do. If you are blessed in such a way, be prepared to be sent to the very fires of hell for the sake of the name of our God. That's where Gideon was sent. Be prepared to go forth in God's name and storm the gates of hell. That's where Gideon went. That's where Jesus told you and I that we are supposed to go. I will be with you, he said. I will be with you. The first assignment was no small task. And I have a sneaking suspicion that the dangerous God delights in giving you and I tasks that are incredibly fraught with danger. Walk by faith, we do, he says. Here's what I want you to do, Gideon. I want you to make an offering to me from your father's cattle. Not even the first one. Give me the second one. And here's the kicker. I'm going to use this to provoke the people and their gods. I want you to tear down your father's altar to Baal. I want you to cut down your father's Asherah pole beside it. I don't want you just to desecrate it. I want you to destroy it. I want you to wreck it. I want you to make it so that no one will even remember that that thing was there. Completely annihilate that old site. Oh yes, these are a formidable defense, to be sure. Two against one. Two great gods from the pantheon of Canaan against you, lowly, weak Gideon. But go ahead. Tear it down, Gideon. And then I want you to do this. After you've torn it down, I want you to build me a new altar. A proper altar, and then offer the bull to me on the new altar. You see, this was no small thing that God was asking Gideon to do. God did not call Gideon to go and start a small fire. He didn't say, Gideon, go preach a sermon. He sent Gideon straight back to home, and he said this, start with your own house, Gideon. Start with your own house, Gideon. Start right in your father's front yard where the idols are located. Start there. And he sent Gideon to the altar of the pagan gods and he had him demolish it. Mind you, this is an act of provocation. It is an act of defiance. Here is the weakest man of the weak standing up against the wishes of his own father, his father's gods, his father's friends, the men of the entire town where they lived. Gideon was about to make a show of things. What God told Gideon to do was to commit some sort of an act of treason against his people. War had been declared. Often it seems to me that the dangerous God asks you and me to do dangerous things. What is a wonder is that the first thing Gideon had to do before Gideon went to rescue Israel from Midian and deliver the crying Israel, restore crops and peace, the first thing Gideon had to do was eradicate false gods and idol worship from the midst of his people. Before God could properly be worshipped by his people, the pagan, the false, the demon-possessed, had to be eradicated from the midst of God's people. You see, because I sense that this here is what's being said. This here is not really good grammar, but you'll bear with me for a minute, okay? Here's what I think is being said. I'm paraphrasing. Gideon, I'm going to use you to rescue my people from Midian. Gideon, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to tear down the altars in your father's front yard. Here's what I think is being said. Israel, it is not Midian that is oppressing you. Israel, it is your false gods that are oppressing you. Huh? Israel, I brought you out of Egypt. I did, but you haven't listened to me. Listen to this. Look at your altars destroyed. Hear my voice, Israel. It is your devil worship that is causing you to be oppressed. Israel didn't even know they were being oppressed on more than one side. Enemies without, enemies within. And they all had to be dealt with. You see, the story of smashing these idols and altars is sandwiched between God calling Midian, or calling Gideon rather, to rescue Israel, and Gideon actually rescuing Israel. In between these two buns here, so to speak, is Gideon rescuing Israel from idol worship. Now that's brilliant. Because before Midian could be moved out, Baal had to go. And it would make no difference in the world for Midian to leave Israel if Israel continued to worship the Baals and the Asherahs. And so when God declares war on the pagan culture that's oppressing us, or rather those who are defying him, he first declares war on the pagan gods who are oppressing us, often at our own invitation, those who are defying him. Gideon's war in Israel began first by a declaration of war on the unrighteousness in the land. You hear this, right? His declaration of war began with the declaration of war on the unrighteousness in the land. You see, we can fight wars all we want against enemies in our land. But I tell you this, if we do not begin by demolishing the altars and the idols we set up in our own front yards, then we are in no less captivity. Furthermore, I don't think it's enough to tear down and demolish the pagan gods' altars. If the unrighteousness associated with them, and the unrighteousness associated with them, if we are not going to establish a righteousness in their place. You see, you can tear down the altars. God said, tear down the poles. But then he said this, build a new altar, a proper altar, and offer right sacrifices to me on the new one. You can get rid of unrighteousness all you want, but if you don't replace it with what is right and good and just and holy and honoring and pleasing to God, then you may as well have left the altars of unrighteousness sitting in your front yard. When righteous people stand up and obey this dangerous God, the pagan gods of this world will not be able to defend themselves. And what we learn is that these pagan gods are as weak as those who prop them up. They cannot defend themselves against those who go forth in the name of the Lord of hosts. They are powerless in the face of a righteous God of the universe. Who can stand up to God, the Lord? It has been said that all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for righteous people to do nothing about it. We are servants of the King, and he will not go down to defeat. Chapter 7 of the book of Judges. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped along the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. So in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, announce now to the people that anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 people left. They only had 32,000. They only had 32,000 to go up against an army whose camels were like the sea and the seashore, whose army was so big they were like a swarm of locusts. So 22,000 left, 10,000 remain. But the Lord said to Gideon, there's still too many. Too many men. Take them down to the water, and I'll sift them there for you. If I say this one shall go, he shall go. But if I say that one does not go, he shall not go. So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, separate those who lap water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink. 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths, and all the rest got down on their knees to drink. And the Lord said to Gideon, with 300 men that have lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place. And so Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept 300 who took over the provisions and the trumpets of others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in a valley. And during the night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up and go down to the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. If you're afraid to attack it, well, go down to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what is being said. Afterward, you will be encouraged to attack the camp. So he and the servant went down to the outpost of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern peoples had settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Wow! That's a big army. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling his friend of a dream. I had a dream, he said. A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed. His friend responded, this can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given Midian and the whole camp into his hands. When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped God. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, get up! The Lord has given the Midianites into your hands, dividing his 300 men into three companies. He placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them, with torches inside. Watch me, he said, follow my lead, and when I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. And when I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. Gideon and the 300 men with him reached the edge of the camp, beginning of the middle watch, just as after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets, broke their jars with their hands. The three companies blew trumpets and smashed them, grasping the torches in their left hands and holding their right hands the trumpets they were to blow. They shouted, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon, which is ironic because they didn't have swords, right? They're carrying jars, torches, and trumpets, but they're shouting about swords. That's irony there. That's cool. While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. And when the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to, I confess I don't know how to say this, Beth Shittah, maybe, towards Zerah, as far as Abel Meholah, and books don't give you help on pronunciation, so I'm sorry. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out. They pursued the Midianites. Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of Jordan. Go on ahead of them as far as Beth Barah. And so all the men of Ephraim, they went out and called. They took the waters of Jordan as far as Beth Barah. They captured two of the Midianites' leaders, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb and Zeb at the rock of Oreb and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb back to Gideon, who was by the Jordan. Let me begin to conclude. Midian would be destroyed by a loaf of bread. Good story. Now what we're seeing is the sort of man that Gideon was. There was no military strategy here. The weakest man from the weakest clan with a mere 300 men who lapped water like dogs went up against an army of 135,000 rather, with a marching band of trumpets, torches, their voices, and some pottery. Not the best weaponry in the world, I suppose. It's reminiscent of Joshua's victory at Jericho. And what's worse, this military genius named Gideon divided his force, not once, but twice, leaving himself three companies divided, each of 100. Not really a very smart military man, now, is he? What sort of sick sense of humor does the Lord happen to have? 300 men against 135,000. What sort of God looks at those odds and thinks that those odds are better than 32,000 against 135,000? When those were the odds, the Lord said, that's too many for me to win. Are you catching this? Are you hearing it? I'm trying to make it obvious. It's astounding, isn't it? It's beyond our comprehension, right? Is this God talking or a stark raving lunatic? 300 wouldn't be good odds against 32,000, let alone 135,000, perhaps more. Maybe less, but I doubt it. And camels. Now it's different. Michael Wilcock notes, and he is weak in chapter 6 because of his inexperience and diffidence. He is weak in chapter 8 because of his self-will and lack of discernment. But both ends of the story teach the same lesson. When the foe is strong and we are so frail, we have to cast ourselves on the Lord. He and Israel with him finds authority and direction in the Lord as they practice the mathematics of Judges chapter 7. The 300 against the 135,000. When I am weak, he says, I am strong. Because we have a dangerous God. And the lesson for Israel was just that. You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel may not boast against me and her own strength has saved her, God would do the same thing in later stories. Isaiah 37, it's 1 against 185,000. In Kings, 2 Kings chapter 7, 4 lepers go out, defeat the army of the Arameans. In 2 Kings chapter 6, the city is surrounded by Arameans, and Elisha's servant is afraid, and Elisha says, Lord, open his eyes that he may see. The Lord opened his eyes and looked, and he saw that the hills were full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Elisha said this to the servant, those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Because you see, when you've got God on your side, you can't lose. Or maybe I should say, when we're on God's side, we won't lose. Huh? Philip Yancey tells of another time when the Lord was rather outnumbered. I love this. I love this quote. It's from his book, The Jesus I Never Knew. He says this, underdog. He says, I went even as I write the word, especially in connection with Jesus. It's a crude word, probably derived from dogfighting and applied over time to predictable losers and victims of injustice. And yet, he says, as I read the birth stories about Jesus, I cannot help but conclude that though the world may be tilted toward the rich and the powerful, God is tilted towards the underdog. Huh? He has brought down rulers, Mary said, from their thrones, but he has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but he has sent away the rich empty. Oh, hallelujah. He's the God of the underdog, the dangerous God. This is the God who turns weakness into strength, who turns stumbling blocks into messages of salvation, who turns death into life, who delights in weakness, who sides with the underdog, the average, who delights in the humble and smites the proud, who blesses those who are cursed, who delights more in two mites from a poor woman than all the wealth in the universe, who will not despise a contrite heart and justifies the repentant sinner, but sends home the unrighteous, self-righteous braggart, who fills the wisdom of the simple and crushes the wisdom of the wise, who lifts up the shaken and crushed and pronounces judgment on the principalities and the powers of this world by the cross of Jesus Christ. This is the God who does more with less, who does the impossible with the improbable, who will not snuff out a smoldering wick or crush a bruised reed, who demands that we become like little children to enter into his kingdom. This is the God who takes murderers and makes them evangelists, who lets prostitutes into the kingdom ahead of seminary scholars, who turns the demon-possessed into revivalists, and who sends his son in the same flesh that he hopes to redeem. This is our dangerous God. Read the Bible. You'll find him there. This is the God who does things exactly the way people cannot understand, who confounds the brilliance of the brilliant. This is why the wise and learned cannot get in. They're too smart for their own good. They think they have to outthink God to make God happen in their lives. He rewards faith. He rejects ambition. This is the God we serve who saved Gideon. This is the God who saves us not by our own strength so that we would boast, but who saves us by grace so that our only boast is in the cross of Jesus Christ. This is a story about God, not about Gideon. It's the story about God who is offended by altars built to pagan gods. And why? Because it's his world. This is the story about a God who will use less to accomplish more. This is the story about a God who will not allow man to overshadow his righteousness or even brag that it was man who accomplished something. This is the story of the great God, the King who delights to give victory in his name and his strength. And all we have to do, and mind what I say here, all we have to do is get the hell out of the way, because it is often that very hell in the form of unrighteousness and pagan gods that is in the way. You hear what I'm saying, right? So that you're not offended that I said get the hell out of the way, right? Get rid of the pagan gods and watch the enemies of God turn on their heels and flee. There's no bigger fan of Rosie O'Donnell in the world than me. You know this. I've spoken to you often about my affections for Rosie O'Donnell. Recently, the Rosie one made this statement. Back in October, here's what she said, mind you, and I quote, "Radical Christianity is just as threatening as radical Islam in countries like the United States." Do you know what's worse? There's something worse than that. 80% of evangelical surveys of Christians who were surveyed by the Barna Group after she made the statement strongly disagreed with her statement. And I find this to be absolutely incredible and mind-boggling that we should disagree with something so prophetic. Because the irony is she's right. Yeah. She's right. The problem is not that she made the statement. The problem is that 80% of the people surveyed don't believe it. And you know why? Because this is not a reflection upon our righteousness as much as it is a reflection of our pathetically poor opinion of the God that we serve. I think that we would rather be offended at someone's words than to associate ourselves with a God who is in fact as dangerous as she is suggesting. We would rather be offended by her with righteous indignation than to dare think that God himself is so dangerous that he will do anything it takes to rescue one lousy, rotten sinner from the clutches of hell. Huh? But that's what he did when he sent Christ Jesus to the earth. And I think the Lord, though dangerous as he is, probably likes the odds. The world versus 20. Against the remnants. I have not much affection for the killing ways of Muslims and the adherents of Islam, but they believe their scripture and they believe their God. Fair or unfair, they believe, and they will die a most painful death here on this earth because of their beliefs. Wrong as they may be, I think sometimes we put our hope in the hands of politicians and megachurch preachers with large budgets and TV programs, and not in the hands of the God who says, "That is too many for me." I think we'd rather claim victory for ourselves than to have God's overwhelming strength devour the enemies of unrighteousness in this world. Mark Buchanan wrote in his book, "Your God is Too Safe," he wrote this, mark it well, "Evil is not safe in the presence of a God who is not safe. Nor, and this is the point, is evil safe in the presence of those who forsake the God who is too safe and follow Christ." Legions, meaning Legion, the man who was healed from the demons, legions all over the world live both in terror and in desperate yearning for those who dare to leave the borderland and live in the holy wild. They are the ones who set captives free. This is the God, the dangerous God, who sent his son to this earth for your sins. This is God. Let's stand and sing a song, and I'll invite the band to come back up here.
saw the Lord. After Isaiah caught a glimpse of the Lord in the train of his temple, Isaiah said, "Send me. Send me. I'm ready to go. Send me."